This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Dear Alison, thank you for your generous letter and for your sheaf of poems. At this stage, I've only had time to glance through them. I will respond in detail at a later date. Your writing seems agreeably formal. I'm grateful for that. Sloppy confessionalism wearies me. When I advocate form, I don't mean something corset-like and stultifying. Some time ago, I met the distinguished American poet Stanley Kunitz in New York. He was nearly 100 years old and still going strong. I held his hands as we talked about poetry and the wild flowers of America and Ireland. Kunitz writes, "A badly made thing soon falls apart. It takes only a few years for most of the energy to leak out of a defective work of art. To put it simply, conservation of energy is the function of form." That reminds me of my undergraduate days at Trinity College Dublin, where I attended lectures on Aristotle's Poetics. Our Greek professor, the celebrated Homeric scholar W.B. Stanford, challenged us to bring to next week's class our own definitions of poetry. Mine was, "If prose is a river, then poetry is a fountain." That went down pretty well with the great man. "Deserves a wider audience," he said. Allow me a moment of self-congratulation, Alison. I picture that fountain as both free-flowing and shapely. I think I prefer the word shape to the word form. So, at first glance, your poems please me by being shapely. I shall be reading them later on to find out how free-flowing they are. I shall be looking out for signs of life and energy. Stanford used to quote Plato, "Kalapa ta kala," the beautiful things are difficult. I have always worked hard at the craft of writing and relish its grammar and syntax. This was drummed into me at an early age. Even at primary school, we were taught to parse words and analyse sentences. As a 10-year-old, I was something of a virtuoso and a pain in the neck to my classmates, no doubt. As a teenager, I was stretched on the rack of Latin and Greek prose composition. Nowadays, Latin and Greek have largely vanished from the school curriculum. Is this why much contemporary verse, in whatever form, is so flabby and wan, so spasmodic or diffuse, spineless stuff? Syntax is poetry's backbone. Bring back Latin and Greek, say I. My two favourite definitions of poet are the Scots word macker and Horace's phrase musarum sacerdos, maker and priest of the muses, craft and vision, the religious side of things and the technical side. I can share with you my secrets, Alison, my trade secrets, but I can't begin to explain the mystery. But it's the mystery I live for, those moments when the words dance down the page beyond my control, when intuition races ahead of cogitation. When this happens, I am concentrating so ferociously the hours fly past. That kind of concentration is the most powerful drug I know, more powerful than food or drink or sex even. It's my drug of choice. Rilke says, "Artistic experience lies so incredibly close to sexual experience, to its pains and pleasures, that both phenomena are really just different forms of one and the same desire and felicity." In other words, poetry can be very sexy. Poetry is my means of making sense of existence, conjuring shape and pattern from life's confusions. For me, writing a poem is a religious experience, a journey into unknown territory. As it evolves, the form of a poem, its shape, works like a compass and helps me find my way to places I didn't know existed. I have to wait for poetry, to be attentive and prepared and hopeful. In my 40s, I waited for 8 long years. I wrote hardly anything. I thought I was finished. I now know that silence is part of the enterprise. Sooner silence than forgeries. At least I didn't fake anything. I agree with Philip Larkin, who says that a poem cannot be an act of the will. I believe in the old-fashioned notion of inspiration. I once said in an interview, if I knew where poems come from, I would go there. Wherever it is, perhaps we'll meet there, Alison. It could be a frightening place, an elemental landscape, a strange city, no man's land. We may need each other's company. Students sometimes ask me about my routine. Mischievously, I reply that I don't write anything for 8 years, and then I produce 3 poems in a single day. I'm trying to shake them up a bit. Often, they have been dulled by the paradigms of academic literary study or by the wrong kind of creative writing course. When I was Ireland Professor of Poetry, I would invite my students to do something really revolutionary, to read a poem and simply enjoy it. I used to insist that they read poems aloud, and I'd ask them to learn some lines by heart. It's tragic how so many folk, even after years of literary study, don't know how to read a poem aloud. Poetry is voiced for the inner ear, so that it can speak to others, so that it can be heard. Robert Frost said, "The ear is the only true writer and the only true reader." Poetry existed long before alphabets. Poetry was first of all, and still is, an oral art. Homer was recited by heart a long time before he was written down and read with the eye. A good poem compels you to hear the lines, which can be long or short, but not too long to be cracked like a whip, or too short to be tied like a broken shoelace. Rhythm is what makes poetry memorable. It's what makes poetry poetry. To quote Duke Ellington, "It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing." Rilke writes, "Love between one person and another, that is perhaps the hardest thing it is laid on us to do, the utmost, the ultimate trial and test, the work for which all other work is just preparation." That's why, counterintuitively, he advises his young poet to become more mature before attempting love poems. I have long believed that love poetry is at the heart of the enterprise. If poetry is a wheel, then the hub is love poetry, and branching out from the hub, like spokes, are all the other involvements and attachments. Family, children, friends, nature, animals, country. The you in my love poems assembles around herself all my loves, all my females, mother, sister, daughters, granddaughters, girlfriends. She also reminds me of my own feminine side. To write a good poem, especially a good love poem, I must be true to my nipples. Publishing has always mattered to me. Marigolds, the first poem I ever published, appeared in the spring 1960 issue of Icarus, Trinity's appropriately named undergraduate literary magazine. Back home in Belfast for Easter, I failed to keep it from my dying father's attention. "Not worth the paper it's printed on," he said. I was embarrassed and deeply disappointed. I was also undeterred. "Be true to yourself," the ancient Greeks advised. Well, I remained true to myself. Despite my father's dismissal, I continued to write. 41 years later, I went to Buckingham Palace to receive the Queen's Gold Medal for poetry. A marvellous surprise and a great honour. I showed the Queen a photograph of my father receiving the Military Cross from her grandfather, George V. "May I ask where that photograph was taken?" I said. She recognised the spot and, after the audience, arranged for her equerry to take me there. I worked out from the photograph precisely where to stand, following in my brave father's footsteps to where he, in 1918, had received his Medal for Valour on the battlefield. I held my own medal, the Gold Medal for Poetry, for what Yeats calls this sedentary trade. And I thought to myself, Marigold's wasn't such a bad poem after all. A few more points before I close, Alison. You may take your poems seriously, but never yourself. Self-importance inscribes its own headstone. And you must avoid calling yourself a poet. When you hear someone begin a sentence, "As a poet I," you can be pretty sure that the speaker is not a poet. That's like calling yourself a saint. A poet is what I and you most want to be. We live in hope that one day other people will call us poets. Rilke wrote to his young friend that poetry is its own reward. When I was your age, I hoped that in my lifetime I would receive just enough recognition to keep me from worrying about its absence. I still think that. Embark on the inner adventure, as Rilke says, without ever asking after the rewards that may come from outside. Rilke also advises, ask yourself in your night's quietest hour, must I write? Maybe that's a trifle high-flown. The best poetic advice I ever received was similar, but more down to earth. One of our Northern Irish number was complaining about being neglected. John Hewitt, poet, wise man, and occasional curmudgeon, responded by saying crisply, if you write poetry, it's your own fault. I'm pleased you contacted me, Alison. I look forward to reading your poems. I remain your friend in poetry, Michael Longley.